Yes. So here's what we decided. We decided that we get the fewest comments in the Q&A of any class we've had so far. So we have a PowerPoint, but we don't intend to go through it. We decided we would just have our notes, and we would put the goals up there, and we would talk through the class. And that hopefully that would make this more discussion-based and allow us to bring out what is on your mind or cover things that you're like, I don't want to email that. So that's...
Yeah, I know you think that because we're sitting down, our answers will be shorter, but that may be hopeless.
Okay, yeah, so I mean, these were the goals, right? To expect to be different, to learn something useful, to establish convictions, to act on that conviction, and to influence others. So what do you guys think? Which ones of these do you think we did well on? Which ones as a class is it like, hey, if we could squeeze a little bit more in, I think we still need more on this side? Like, what are your thoughts? Yes. Okay. So I would say one part of that that I think Eric always hit really well is asking people, you know, is there something about Christianity that you find offensive or distasteful or something like that? And let them have a chance to air that. I can remember Ricky Shanks always saying that he would never ask people what their religious background was. He would just go straight to the scriptures. Well, there's a value in that approach. Eric has the exact opposite approach. Like, what is it about the scriptures that you find, like, closed-minded or difficult or something like that? So Eric would have that. And then also, and maybe I'm wrong, and you guys feel free to tell me, Philip, you're like living in a bubble world. Get out here, man. Like, there is a sense in which we come back to say, you know, where do you think the standard for good comes from? Is it always completely individual? Or is there, do you find some standard for good? Like, how do you determine what's good and what's bad, or what's right and what's wrong? Because everybody has something. And that's part of what we're doing on the Tuesday night study at Kroger's, is the Tim Keller book, The Reason for God, where he's walking through those kind of questions to bring out, like, is there anybody in the world right now that could be doing something that although they personally believe it's right, you would find yourself in the need to tell them, no, you have to stop that activity. And if you can envision some person somewhere in the world doing some activity that although they think it's justified, you would say, no, under no circumstances is that activity justified, then what is your basis for that?
If you have a door open and you can drive through with some of those things, sometimes you don't even feel like you have that, right? So there's nothing wrong with being so. We're told also about casting your pearls before. Sometimes there's not an opportunity. But maybe one standard of judgment to consider is, has my silence left the impression that I do agree with this? I'm in support of something that I'm really not. And if you feel strongly that that's what it has done, then you may be compelled to find some way. You've got to say something in order to avoid that. But otherwise, I mean, the judgment sometimes says there's nothing I really can do effectively in this moment.
And maybe this is being, again, you know, I'm in some of those circumstances, I'm not as many, right? Because y'all are my clients, right? Like, I have the best clients ever. But no, I mean, we have studies, right, with the loss and everything. And sometimes you just come back to somebody to say, like, hey, we don't have to agree about that to do this project together. And so you've let them know in a very direct way, we do not agree about this. But you've also said, I want to do this project with you. And there are times I think we have to use those kind of statements.
Other goals, other comments about what got covered or didn't? We'll hold off on it for just a little bit, but I think it'll come back and make sure that it relates back to what you said. I think it'd be good to hear if there's more perspective. That's really helpful because that kind of says we didn't fully accomplish one of the goals, which was to equip parents to be better capable of dealing with this circumstance.
Let me kick in just the part that won't be on the other, but I'll tell you what I've found so amazing with the young adults, you know, 20s, early 30s, that have agreed to go have coffee, right? The ones that have struggled and have just poured their heart out so many times. It's like Genesis 1 through 3. To go back and establish God as a creator. To go back and establish Adam and Eve having free will choice. about whether or not to sin, to go and look at the consequences with Cain and Abel. I mean, I'm just thinking of different ones that even in their lowest lows, the most progress they made was kind of reconfirming that basic picture. And we're going to put some of this in on Sunday night about using that, and we touch on it a little bit, but I know that sounds elementary, but it has been eye-opening, both for me and for them, to go back and just think about how many foundational concepts about who God is and our walk with Him that they just need to go over again. I mean, I can remember calling David Banning when I was in my early 20s and being like, we don't ever cover the Holy Spirit, and I know nothing about the Holy Spirit. And he's like, tell me everything you know about the Holy Spirit. And 25 minutes later, he's like, I think you know more than you give yourself credit for. You know, and there's times that I'm having coffee with people like that, and we're getting down to what is the real sin they're struggling with, what are the influences in their life that's pulling them away, and when they get kind of re-solidified around some of those really fundamental concepts, I've just seen it be more effective than I expected. That's great. Great question.
Any other comments about the goals or things that maybe didn't get fully covered or worth knowing? Because the class is going to get repeated somewhere down the line. Or why don't we go to that question?
Okay, that sounds great.
A question was posed to us about how can good parents, this was in quotes, but I think you can picture this, really is all of us would consider these to be good parents, have kids that turn out to be non-believers or lacking in morals. And they went on to say there are a lot of Old Testament examples, but there are so many in our own present day. This goes back to your point, Brad, about we see this happening. That was a concern the elders had when we first talked about this class. We can point to examples of young people grew up here, got caught up in different teachings, ideas, moral practices, sinful things, and just drifted away completely from God. So how do you kind of think about, how can that be? How can good parents have that happen? So I think that there's a lot at work in the question, and we wanted to offer a little bit of advice in it, but I think the first thing that, you want to take a stab at it first? Or
I think you go on.
All right, so, you know, one thing that kind of quickly comes to mind in this is, I hear this question almost like, what are we doing wrong? I've heard this several times from a number of mothers here just recently. What are we doing wrong here? I thought we were giving our kids all the things they needed to know. I know they were taught the right things here or something. It's like this tremendous amount of doubt and question because we taught them the right things, but they're not doing. They don't believe or they're not doing the right things. How can that possibly be is sort of the essence of that. It goes back to your Phyllis point about free will. We either acknowledge that's the way God made us or we don't. And yet we've got this passage in Proverbs 22, verse 6, which I think we misapply this. I think we misapply probably a lot of the Proverbs when we look at a statement that says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. And we view that as an absolute black and white statement as opposed to a principle, a truism. And if you doubt that, read all of Proverbs 22. There's a whole bunch of other things said in there, too, and I think you'd acknowledge those aren't absolute statements. It's not absolutely true. You bring up a child in the way that he'll go, he'll never depart from that. But think about what the Proverbs is trying to say. Expose a child early on to good things, to the truth, and they're going to stay with them. And I think there is a truth. You're going to say something about prodigals, I know, but a part of the hope for prodigals is they're not going to forget what you taught them when they were young. I mean, it's going to matter. So I was trying to kind of think through just a few thoughts about, okay, here's this challenge with younger ages being exposed to these things. How do we continue to teach the truth but do it in as effective a way as we can? And please understand, I'm trying to throw out some ideas. I was a little intimidated when I was thinking about this because I got two of my kids in the class. So if you want to know how this didn't really happen necessarily in our household or what might have worked or didn't, you can always go up and ask them about it. You know, ultimately, the goal that you're trying to do is help every child establish their own individual, independent, personal faith. And that's a scary challenge when it's like, but this is what you need to believe. But it's got to be their belief. And I mean independent. They have to reach some of their own conclusions, but they have to have some freedom to make their choices in some way. So that's, you can see how that's a difficult balance. One of the things that seems to me are important is you got to allow and encourage any question. And what happens to us oftentimes as parents is, in principle, we want to do that, but we're scared. I mean, have you ever been a parent scared of a question like, okay, please don't ask me that one. Don't ask me that question. It's like, or they ask it in a way, and you're like, you're almost dumbfounded that they even have that question. And the shock in your face completely shuts down the discussion because, you know, but you want to encourage any question. They can come, they can talk to you about that because you want to be the resource to them. And I think that also says here's this challenge of your kids are not the same. Whatever works for the first child is not necessarily going to work for the second or the third. So you have to develop this deep relationship with each one so that they will come to you and want to talk to you. And I think that then means that if they come or if you've encouraged these questions and things, we need to be honest that we don't have all the answers. I don't know the answers. You know, if they ask a question and I don't know the answer, I need to tell them I don't know that. Or if there's a moral kind of question and it exposes some of the weaknesses in my life and maybe I've been too harsh or too angry or something along the way that's kind of exposed my lack of following, well, I need to be willing to say, you know what, I was wrong. Because I really want to follow the Lord. And so that willingness to acknowledge what we've done. But at one time, we went back and we looked at, like, here are all the high school rosters. And everybody, you know, 10, 15 years later. I know we did it from several years before Mason Broadwell's class. If you can think about that age and kind of look. The most correlated factor of who remained faithful in the future years were the parents were faithful. I mean, steadfast. Really, truly lived out what they said you're supposed to do. It's not the only factor. I know we just said, you know, what happens when good parents and kids go off even though the parents were good. But it's still so important. And I think that what that means for us as parents is we have to live out what we're teaching. But also make sure they see the most important thing in life is following Christ. Because I've watched parents oftentimes leave the impression the most important thing is what college you get into. It's how successful you are in life. It's how well you can handle. Do you have good friends or not? You know, even like, do you have good Christian friends? No, ultimately the most important thing is, are you going to follow Christ or not? And if you can't see that in me as a parent, I think it's kind of difficult for me to say that the child is going to follow that. And again, I made mistakes. When you make the mistakes, acknowledge it. I think those are things that are part of the challenge. And I'm not going to give you all the answers, but those are some. And so especially one more thing that we need to be aware that what you didn't see till you were 17, 18, 19 years old, maybe already in college, were exposed to, 10 and 11-year-olds are being exposed to. And we just need to know that, see that, and respond in a different way than we would have even a few years ago.
That's true.
I think about various prodigals and ones we work with. I think we always want to remember free will. We want to remember immaturity. We want to remember that a lot of time being a prodigal is temporary. You know, you think about people that literally the parents die and 10 years later that kid comes back to the Lord, right? Just there's circumstances in life that unfold there. But one I'll specifically mention is we have to give credit for how strong some temptations are. Like when I think about some of the best parents, just all-star parents that have children that have fallen away, it was often alcohol. You know, and not any one drink or one bar or one club, other than like the sustained path that they ended up going down that kid never expected they were going to go down, right? And so I think maybe being alert to our kids' temptations and really trying to help them see those long-term consequences, which obviously, I mean, every parent does, right? We know we're doing that. But don't dismiss how strong those temptations are. And I think if you think of the mechanics of it, what typically is happening is that something's being displaced, right? Not just denied, right? It's a lot to deny that there is a God when you've gone to church ever since, you know, you could fit in a bucket class. And I don't see a lot of the 20-somethings that I've worked with denying it. It's displaced. And that makes me think about 2 Timothy 4:10 about Demas having loved this present world, right? He's forsaken me. Demas, it's not that he denies God. It's just it gets displaced by all these concerns. And when there is so much pressure, you know, on young adults, getting things started, relationships, finances, all those different things, it's just easy for those to get displaced. So that to me is a big warning. I think you guys all know this, like making sure it's not just rules to follow. And even I was listening to a podcast today, saying making sure it's not just a destination to arrive at. That yes, if you miss heaven, you missed it all. But it's about a lot more than a destination, right? It's about our relationship with God. So not just rules to be followed, not just a destination to reach. And then, like I alluded to on Sunday, that disappointment with our faith. Other thing is, what? And maybe there are definitely parents in this room that can answer this better than me because we haven't crossed this bridge yet. But what is that age where you start to have conversations with your young adults about the fact that you see hypocrisy also? In a dedicated class in the auditorium, all about how do we deal with hypocrisy? Because we know that our kids spot hypocrisy in us as parents, and we know that they can see hypocrisy within the local church. How come that person that just led the closing prayer does XYZ the other 6 days a week, right? Like, those are okay conversations to have at a certain point of maturity, but it is damaging to young adults when they perceive that they're the only ones that see the hypocrisy, right? It's the stupidity of their arrogance. That they're the only ones that see the hypocrisy. And they need to know that you see that too, but that you're extending grace and that you are aware of your own imperfections and that people might think you're a hypocrite. Like, that, to have that conversation, I think, would be helpful for our young adults.
I guess that's the question, is that really, when we define good parenting, that's part of it, is to identify that it's not enough just to have had a nice family life, and we went to church consistently. That's kind of what I was trying to allude to in the idea of they need to see what is truly the most important thing. And among the ways you do that, I think, is to limit that outside influence. You know, parents should care about who your kids' friends are, who they're associating with, where they go, the things that they do. All of that's important. I did have kind of a thought related to that. I think sometimes we want to figure that out and attack that by simply saying something like, well, they can't have any bad influences, so public schools are out, right? Like, if I can cut out that influence, then I know that my kids will be okay. And yeah, look around, you know, in this church and the ones who've grown up, there are a lot of them who grew up all the way through public schools, and they're fine. On the other hand, somebody else will say, you haven't given them enough opportunity. You're homeschooling them. You're not giving them enough opportunity to kind of deal with the world and be ready for that. Because, you know, they'll hit 20 and they'll have no independence. They won't know what to do. So look at all the homeschool kids who are doing fine. You know, have grown up, and then, you know, that they've been protected from some of those influences and they've done well. So I think the key is it's not like there's a formula to this. It really is digging down and knowing enough about what's happening in the life of your kids that you are trying to protect from those influences and temptations, but with real reasons as to why not to.
Do we need not only to answer it with biblical truth, but also show the shortcomings and the holes in some of, like, the humanistic arguments or the secular arguments?
Glenn, you were about to say something.
I would say yes. I think we do. I mean, a good example is we're getting ready to teach evidence this next segment in the high school class, and then after that, evolution. And I'm teaching that class, and I would be very overt about it. Here's what you're going to hear in school. Let's talk about it. And I think a lot of those arguments around evolution, they kind of implode on themselves, even just using worldly wisdom and knowledge. So let's start with there. We have a class here also that's on world religions, and we went through like 13 different world religions. Just let's go to the website and see what they believe and why. Again, not casting dispersions on anything, not even opening the Bible, but just as a starting place, does this make sense to you guys? And oftentimes, it kind of demotes itself out of the gate. So I think it's a very powerful tool to be very overt. You have kind of home court advantage. You have the first chance to have a conversation. I'd rather present someone else's evidence first and then let them follow later when they've already heard me kind of tear it apart. It's a shame if we let our kids hear things for the first time about a different religion or a different moral issue or a different scientific issue and they haven't heard about it from us first.
Which is back to that point of things being exposed too much earlier. It's like I might have thought I didn't need to have that conversation for
so this 15.
Right. But today I might need to have had it already at 11 or 12, and I didn't even understand that that was necessary. The other thing is that, look, there's so many challenges out there. It's great to say you can show the fallacy of a lot of this. Sometimes we read them and we don't know what the fallacy is. That's okay. That's why we're a group. We're working together. Find out what the challenge is that you feel like your child needs to have answered, and let's work together to kind of find that. That's really meant to be open up to these discussions, is to say, don't feel like you're in an isolated or a silo where you got to answer everything all by yourself. No parent knows all the answers. That is, by the way, the approach, or has been for a long time in the evidences classes that are taught here, is to establish that kind of core belief. You can't know the answer to every single question, but once you are confident in those things, you're right. It's like, I hear this bizarre thing and it really disturbs me, but then I stop for a moment and I remember what I do know for sure. And I think, oh, there's an answer to that. I just need to go find it. But I'm calm until I find it. But 13-year-olds aren't. I wasn't at 17. I didn't hit. I had all kinds of questions at 17 and 18. And I was not calm about it. I can remember not being able to sleep at night, because I couldn't figure out, you know, working through certain things. And, you know, but once the answers were there, there were answers to my questions. I just didn't know the answers at a certain age. And so, great anxiety.
So I emailed myself some of the slides that we did in the auditorium that we never got to cover in here. And so let me say, like, when you're looking for the holes in the argument, you already know what the hole is going to be. You just have to find it in that particular argument. If you think about the passages in the Bible about idols, and what we covered in the auditorium is that idolatry always ended up either powerless or disappointed. Right? God again and again says, it's just a lump of stone. It's just a lump of wood. Like, he showed how powerless it was, and he showed how disappointing it is. So whether it's tribalism or humanism or anything else, if you can look for, how is this powerless or how is this disappointing? The same way God showed that fault in Old Testament idolatry, that will be there. You know it's going to be there because it's alive. So it's going to end up powerless and disappointing. If not those, then you're looking for where is it abusive or where is it extreme? Because idolatry always ended up there. It tore down people being made in the image of God. It led to child sacrifice. It led to them cutting themselves. Like all these different things. It always ended up either powerless, disappointing, abusive, or extreme, or extremely self-centered and extremely lucrative. I mean, that's where idolatry went. When Paul came in to Greece, right? And it's like, I was opposed by Alexander the coppersmith. It was extremely lucrative. And so the same kind of problems that you see with biblical idolatry, that's the problems we're looking for in these arguments today.
Can you repeat those?
It's always powerless or disappointing, abusive or extreme, self-serving, and lucrative. If you can find one of those six things, they're gonna be there. You're gonna be on the right track to showing your kids the problem with that particular mindset. So I really want to squeeze in that this weather a little thing. I'm going to put, I'm going to cheat. I'm going up here. But look, I want y'all to see this survey of 3,000 teenagers. And there's this term called moral therapeutic deism, which is just a really fancy way of saying watered down Christianity. But it's not just watered down Christianity. It's watered down religion as a whole. So think about Jesus saying the rocky soil. It shoots up real quick, but it falls away as soon as the sun is scorching it, right? So they were really excited to get baptized at 16, but boy, at 21, taking biology at such and such university, they're withering, right? It's that kind of picture. So this is what they said. They found many young people believe in several moral statutes not exclusive to just one world religion. This is not a new religion or theology, but it was a common set of spiritual beliefs, a combination they have labeled as moral therapeutic deism, which means we believe there is a God, and He's there to make me happy, and I'm not supposed to hurt people, right? Like, that's the bottom line. There is a God, and He's supposed to help me, you know, fix my marriage or figure out my problems or not feel so afraid at night, and then I'm supposed to be nice, right? It's moral therapeutic deism. So this was their foundation from 3,000 teenagers. There is a God who exists. He did order the world. He wants people to be good and nice and fair to each other. The central goal of life was to be happy and feel good about yourself. He doesn't need to be involved in my daily life except when I need Him to fix something for me, right? And then good people go to heaven when they die. And what the researchers found is that this was the bottom line. Five core qualities. Do no harm. Play fairly. Be loyal to your group. Respect authority. And live purely. Now, I want my kids to have all five of those concepts. But, except for maybe just the group part, right? But do no harm. Play fairly. Be loyal. Respect authority. Live purely. And the point here is, that's not Christianity. That's shallow. That's rocky soil, right? So, you know, I'm the one that proposed that we do the little kid class on Sunday nights, and we teach about humility and obedience and all these patience, all these positive virtues. But it is so very important that we explain Christianity to our teenagers as much, much more than there is a God who wants us to play by the rules and He can make you feel better. Right? That's not enough. And all of us know this, the intricacies of theology, the glory that God deserves, the pursuit of holiness, right? God is a creator, all those extra things. There's just so much more of Christianity than this. And this is being discussed among our brethren. Okay, this is happening. This is real. This is deeply concerning to many preachers. Are we you know, getting too far away from the whole counsel of God that we're only insisting to our kids, there's a God and He's good?
This is idolatry again, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
It's self-worship.
Yes, that's a good way to finish that. Because it's not even that this is anti-doctrinal. You say, oh, yeah, we don't need that. This takes away the whole idea of take up your cross and follow after me, that there's an idea of self-sacrifice involved in serving God, that even if I'm not made happy, if it's pleasing to God, it's worthwhile. Those are difficult concepts sometimes for somebody to accept, but that's what God's challenging us. Well, there's something richer, deeper than
yeah,
what's there.
We talked about happy and joyful in the Philippians class, and they're just about opposite extremes. This is very much centered around, you know, I think your 6 points, you can probably find a couple of them in there.
Mm-hmm. You can see how appealing this is.
But yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And you can see how you thought you did a good job, right? Like, hey, I taught my kid to do no harm and play fairly and be loyal and respect authority. And you can see how, for lack of a better term, like mega church youth group that has great music and hypes them all up and sends them out because Jesus loves you. Like, that's not enough. I will never, ever forget a young woman in Lexington. Her name was Jessica, and she sat on the right-hand side, and she said, when I left those services, I felt better than I would all week. But by Monday or Tuesday, the high was gone, and it was really, really hard. And like, we do not want to give kids a false Jesus high, right? Like, that is not the goal of Christian instruction. That's not what Christianity is. So I think really knowing that. Is that second or first?
That was the first fail, but I think we had one other question.
He was just saying first.
Well, so here was a question that we had gotten. We didn't get to it in the first Q&A, so I don't want to miss it here. Somebody had pointed out, I would like to know more about how to talk to people who believe in miracles. And I specifically want to know how to explain to my kids that miracles in other religions don't have a biblical foundation, which I take to mean don't have a reality, I believe is the statement that's being made there. So how would you go about talking to somebody who believes in miracles, or in particular, how might you distinguish the miracles that are presented in the scriptures versus stories of miracles that come from a lot of different other religions or time periods outside of the biblical time periods? Exactly. Several things, you know, the nature of the miracle. Because oftentimes, if you read these stories of other miracles, they don't stack up in terms of not just what was actually seen or done, but some of them are just silly. Just almost destructive, even anti-godly type of things that have happened. So knowing the context of those other miracles would make a great deal of difference. Who saw them? When did they see them? How did they report them? You know, back to Matt's point about the resurrection. The resurrection is attested to by eyewitnesses who actually sat down and wrote about it within that generation. That's not oftentimes what you see in this. So that's part, you know, the more you can understand the distinction between the two, I think that helps. There's one more thing, too, that I'll go back to you, Trace. I think sometimes when we say miracles, when people say, I believe in miracles, I believe in miracles, what they're really describing is more of, I believe in the power of God to be influential in the world today. And I don't know that I would disagree with that. You know, it depends on what they're describing. And it may not be worth the discussion at all. Now, that's different than trying to explain to your children miraculous stories they've heard somewhere else. But it may be there's not really a conversation to be had because of what they're actually talking about. They're just using words that are not equivalent to a biblical miracle. And if you can't really show the distinction between the two, so what you might be doing is actually undermining belief in miracles at all.
Right?
I mean, so that's a careful thing about it, to understand why we should have confidence in the miracles described in Scripture, but not necessarily others. That is a challenge, for sure. All right. Any other thoughts or questions? Got another minute or so.
We might also remember that it's a wide, wonderful world, and we don't know everything that's
going
on. And there are charlatans out there.
Yeah, so that was part of mine with Acts chapter 8, Simon the Sorcerer. He doesn't specifically attribute it to demons. It just seems to be that he's an imposter, and he's a very convincing one. And so it's, you know, again, that fact that it's extremely lucrative, right? It's good to point that out. For some things are imposters. Acts 16, of course, was the demons and the fortune teller. And so, you know, showing those things that were clearly not from God. We said the same thing as Hebrews 2, the purpose of miracles, the difference, that, you know, New Testament miracles. But you can often do a case study and go in and do a deep dive on any individual miracle, and really it becomes a strong contrast. So we're not trying to say God doesn't answer prayer. And when James 4 tells us to pray for the sick, it's because we believe God answers prayer. But we are trying to say what happened in the New Testament context is really different. Y'all, thank you so much.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.